Ladies and gentlemen, storytellers of all ages, lend your ears to co-hosts Brad and Philip as we delve into the Marketing Your Attraction podcast.
This is episode 18 of the Marketing Your Attraction podcast. I'm Brad. Philip, good morning. How are you? Welcome to another podcast episode.
Good morning. Oh, I'm fantastic this morning. Even though I haven't had coffee yet, it's sitting here to the side of my computer taunting me. But let's talk some marketing. Woo.
Yeah. We have a great show. We're going to talk about everyone's favorite topic, pricing. How do you make money off of your attraction? I know so many of us got into this industry for the passion, enthusiasm, fandom of the industry. But at the end of the day, if you want to continue making attractions and continue investing in them and expanding them, you do have to worry about the bottom line, unfortunately. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in our main topic. Before we get to pricing, let's talk about some of the topics that are in the news this week. So the first story that I found was about California's new data privacy law. So the bill passed, I think, almost unanimously. It's called the California Consumer Privacy Act. We've talked about different privacy laws that have passed in Europe, like the GDPR, some of the issues that Facebook and Twitter have been having about privacy laws, and all of the stories that have been in the news. And this is sort of a culmination of all of that. And what this law is going to eventually do when it'll take effect in the beginning of 2020. And when it does, it could really turn the tech world's business model on its head. And this article from CNET talks a little bit about that. So the quote from this is, regular internet users will be able to ask for the data a company has collected on them and whom the data has been sold to. That alone could be eye-opening for consumers. Most people understand their online activity is being tracked for targeted advertising, but we don't have a broad understanding of what data is being used. The bill will take effect at the beginning of 2020, end quote there. I think this will really open the eyes of a lot of consumers and just bring further scrutiny to consumer privacy and where consumer data is being used. The reason I wanted to mention on the show, you have a couple of years before, about a year and a half before it takes effect. And there's going to be a lot more news and details on the regulation. They're just sort of figuring it out right now in the Attorney General's office. So it's nothing to worry about right away. But I think for smaller attractions and even bigger attractions that are not doing a great job of tracking what data they have on consumers and where it's being sold to, the next year or so is the time to really get that figured out, whether it's a simple Excel spreadsheet or a more complicated CRM database. No matter what size attraction you have, you're going to want to make sure you're keeping records on this, because pretty soon a consumer will be able to write in, request the data you have on them, request where it's been sold. And if you're not able to comply, if you're in California, you will be able to be fined. And I think also if you do business in California, and usually once California passes a law, it's not too long until the rest of the country follows suit. Especially a lot of, states like New York and Washington tend to follow California's lead on this data privacy stuff. So just a heads up on there. Our next news story is kind of similar to this. So Facebook and Twitter this week released a tool that now publicly shows all ads a brand is running. And this is in response to all of these data privacy inquiries that have been coming in a lot of the Russia political ad scrutiny that came about from the last election. The reason I mention it on our podcast is I actually think it's really cool that they released this data tool, because now you can go to any brand's page and see what ads they're running, which is great to get competitor information and also just to get ideas. I've been having fun looking at our competing theme parks here in the Southern California market to see like what Universal and Disney is using for their creative, what pricing models they're targeting consumers to, what creative they're using. It'd be a really great way to get insights on competitors and also just to get ideas too. So definitely try it out. It's available. If you go, I've mostly just been playing with the Facebook version of it. But if you go to any brand's Facebook page and you go to the left-hand side, you'll see a button that says info and ads. This is pretty eye-opening to be able to see this data that for the most part you would never be able to see before. One thing I will caution is if you're running targeted ads to a, let's say you're running a targeted deal to a certain group of people, or whether it's by location or by age or however you're targeting these specific offers, I believe they're now going to come up under that tab. I haven't had enough chance to experiment with it, but that's something to keep in mind, because if you are creating an offer for your attraction that previously could only have been seen by that targeted audience, now anyone could go in, click on info and ads, and be able to find that deal. So that's the one downside on the brand side. But I think it'll have a lot of upside for our audience, because it just gives you a better idea of what your competitors are working on. Have you had a chance to check this out at all, Philip?
Yes. I actually was bringing it up to get some examples while we were talking. And yeah, it is, oh gosh. It's one of those things where I'm not sure if this is a good idea. I guess we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, now that it's out there, you just sort of have to adapt. I was a little shocked at first. It's weird to see, you know, all of your ad work being accessible to the public now. And of course, it doesn't show stats yet or anything like that, or budgeting, but just to be able to see all of a brand's ad creative is really really eye opening.
I mean, it is fascinating because you can look in and see all the creative, but I mean, I have already looked at a few pages that they've had like multiple offers running, like Universal, that have, you know, multiple discount offers running. And I'm assuming that those are segmented offers because they're conflicting offers.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I'm seeing them now too. It's yeah. Save up to $20. Others say save 15. Up to 15.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm assuming that you get to see everyone. You just don't get to see the exact targeting, except, you know, you can look by country, but you can't look by exact targeting, which is, you know, it's very interesting. This is very interesting. I think it'll be, well, I guess we'll see. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, it's definitely going to change, or it should change, you know, the discount game. It should change really any added value game or any incentive game at all, unless you're running, you know, the same streamlined campaign. I'm also wondering how much end users are going to understand how to use it.
Right. Yeah, it might not be a big issue, but if it becomes something where consumers are finding these deals that and then reposting them on
their websites, yeah.
All of those other deal sites. I think Facebook might regret this, because I would be really hesitant to run a segmented discount now that it's publicly out there. And I think it just goes back to what we have talked about many times on the podcast, that you want to own your own relationships with your customers. And that's why email marketing and these direct marketing campaigns that do not use a, you know, third party like Facebook or Twitter are so important, because, you know, in just one moment with the flip of a switch, Facebook completely changes the game again, like they always do. And something that may have been a big focus for a lot of brands of running these segmented targeted offers on Facebook might be in jeopardy. So who knows? We'll have to see how it plays out. I think, you know, I've been in digital marketing for so long at this point that I no longer get disappointed when I see changes like this. I try to be optimistic about it. I think that's the good and bad thing about marketing, is it's always changing, right? So you just have to sort of roll with the punches. But this could be quite a big change, and something for all of us to keep an eye on, to see how, to your point, if consumers are recognizing that this is a place where this is a way that they can now find coupon deals that they may not have been able to find beforehand. Mm-hmm. Social media. You had a great story about a social media platform that I don't think a lot of us pay enough attention to. No, I don't.
Yeah, I had a quick article. It's a very short article. The gist of it is here, but it's titled... Pinterest is growing faster than Twitter and Snapchat and offers significant opportunities. And this is from Social Media Today. And basically, here from the article, Pinterest may not be growing at the rate the company had once anticipated, but the platform is expanding, with new data showing that the app is now closing in on 250 million monthly active users, up from 200 million it reported back in September. That is pretty quick growth, actually. And, you know, it, as I mentioned earlier... you know, sometimes you just, you kind of like put blinders on, and I've definitely had blinders on for Pinterest. When I've gone to conferences, I've just kind of, if it said Pinterest in the name, I just kind of like blocked it out of my field of vision. So I wouldn't have to, you know, even make a decision to go or not. So I've kind of lost track of it. So I saw this article pop up, and I thought it was just very interesting to look back at the platform and see what's been going on with them. And, you know, there have been a lot of changes, and they've been working in some logic and really embracing the whole related products and recommendations for people. And I'm sure there's examples of this working for theme parks, but I don't have any in front of me. But I just thought it was very interesting that this, you know, obviously they're not near you know, Facebook or Twitter, but that's pretty significant growth. So this is very interesting. I also wonder on the side if there's like a plateau cap, you know, to social media platforms, because, you know, the gulf between Facebook and every other platform is so great, and every other platform kind of seems to plateau at a peak. So I'm wondering if all of that growth that I think the tech community was thinking, like exponential growth for every social platform, is just not true anymore because of kind of like Facebook's dominance.
Yeah. And there's only so many people in the world, but this is a great reminder. I need to take another look at Pinterest as well. We've dabbled in it a couple of times at Knots, and it has a great family audience. I think it's just one of those. I think the demographics maybe are not the young hip celebrities are using it, and so you just don't see a lot of coverage like you would of Twitter and Instagram. And I think Facebook's the 800-pound gorilla, so you always see coverage of that. But I mean, Pinterest is almost, I think they're almost as big as Twitter with monthly active users at this point. And depending on your demographic that your attraction's targeting, if it's targeting families, and that's Pinterest is where a lot of moms and dads who are into sharing family ideas and like family recipes and all sorts of stuff like that could be a really lucrative market for that. So thank you for the reminder. I need to take my blinders off and
get back out there,
get back in there into Pinterest. Awesome. Well, that's our news for this week. Some quick takes there. And as always, there's something new in marketing every single week. It just never stops. So our main topic this week is pricing your attraction. Philip, you want to dive into this a little bit?
Sure. So the first thing we have on here is whether or not you're looking at this from a value or a luxury play, because there's a few different elements to pricing. And as I mentioned to Brad earlier, you know, I have kind of a skewed reference points with pricing, because I've always priced things using competitive analysis reference points and doing like a little bit of testing or getting in kind of outside help for it. Hiring a consultant or to give opinions on what the market will bear and whatnot and where we are, where we sit in it. Yeah, one of the first considerations here is, you know, thinking about the frame that you're putting yourself and considering whether or not you're luxury or you are value kind of within that frame. And I guess one of the examples I have, it doesn't translate like one for one necessarily into the attraction space, but you know, for pricing for Gantam, there's a lot of because our lights can be used by so many markets, which is really a unique feature, because a lot of commercial lights can't actually be used by a lot of different markets because of the size and other components with them. Because our lights can be used by so many markets, they bleed into attractions and escape rooms and haunts, and they also then are used in full-scale theme parks and water zoos, aquariums, then they get into museums, and they get into into architecture. So in regular commercial buildings, even in housing and in dorm projects, multifamily projects, and in doing themed environments for restaurants as well, and casino work. So they really run the full gambit, which is very unusual for a commercial lighting brand. So it presents this weird framing problem because on the one end, when you're pricing it for escape rooms and for haunts, it's definitely seen as a luxury item because of the price point here and because of some of the competitive landscape within there. You know, they're looking at you know, when you're really young haunt, maybe you're just getting consumer lights and trying to make them work, or you're buying some stuff even from Walmart or from Home Depot or Spirit Halloween, or these regular lighting effects that you're putting into your stuff, or you're running lights that you can just buy as a consumer that you don't need a rep for, or you don't need like a spec for, that you're just buying to put into your that kind of stuff. But then when you get over into the film or the architecture side of things, you know, on the film side, you know, a lot of our lights are seen as disposable because they are, comparatively speaking, you know, for the category, like for a small light that lights in the way that we do, for that category in film, they're so inexpensive that they are disposable. So they don't even bother to store them because they're disposable. So in that one, they're really, really in the value disposable end. And then they're pretty close to that end on the architecture as well. You know, they're in terms of similar lumen fixture or similar data fixtures that they replace, they're less than half the cost. So it's just very weird juggling. So there's a lot of juggling that we have to do in the kind of the brand management, the frame management, you know, of these different markets, is being aware of the market that it's going into and how that market is going to perceive the brand. And you know, either you're sticking by your value or you're leading with value, depending on where you're sliding into.
Yeah, sort of a comparison in the attraction industry. If take Disneyland for example, obviously they're, you know, higher end. They would be, I guess, the luxury play of the theme park industry and the attractions industry. But it really depends on what consumer they're targeting and what product they're targeting to, depending on whether they have that value pricing message or if they're just going luxury. Because when they do like their 3-day discount tickets, usually in the off season, they're targeting the consumers who are investing a lot in that family trip. You know, that's a lot of money for that segment that they're targeting. And so that messaging is a lot different than some of their other more, you know, less price focused, whether, you know, targeting higher income families who don't see those ticket prices as a bigger investment. So for example, if you have a family of four and, you know, your middle income, a trip to Disneyland is a significant investment, right? And so they're going to be very price conscious. Whereas if you're much higher income, family of four, it could be viewed as a drop in the bucket. So you really have to think about who are you targeting, and not just what price do you want to charge, but how are people going to view that? Because on, you know, the Knott's Berry Farm side, we're much more of a value play. But even though our tickets are significantly cheaper than a Disneyland or Universal Studios, and we're definitely the value play in the Southern California market, just because we're charging less doesn't mean that consumers are necessarily seeing us as that value play or as like a cheap, easy option for them. Because if a family of four of, you know, lower to middle income is looking at buying tickets or season passes, that's still a really big investment for their family. Imagine the journey your customer is going through when they're looking at your pricing, and making sure that you're explaining that. Because the pricing is obviously a number price, but it's more than that. You have to look at, okay, well, are we going with the season pass play to it? Do we have to explain like this is a ton of value that you're getting for it? If you're going the luxury realm, like a lot of escape rooms and higher end haunted house experiences do in the Los Angeles market, where you're charging, you know, $100-$150 for a, you know, 30 to 60 minute experience, you have to describe that in a much different way than you would if you were selling a haunted house for, you know, $25 to $30. So I always try to say, start with your pricing to make sure that you can cover all of your costs and make a profit. I mean, that's the most important place to start. So you need to understand all those costs. And then after that, you need to start doing competitive research. And this can be as easy as Googling to as complicated as getting, you know, a pricing consultant and really trying to figure out where it makes sense to target in your market. You probably want to, at the very least, do some research and look at what are the incomes, what are the family sizes in the area that you're targeting. A lot of that information is free through the U.S. Census, or you can go through your local visitors bureau. Like we talked about on the show before, they're a great resource to get that type of information. So you don't want to come out with a really high-end haunted house or escape room or whatever the attraction is experience if the market's not going to be able to support that. So that's a little bit about pricing, and then kind of going into an example of how you can test this. Because I really recommend testing pricing for events even before you necessarily develop an event. You want to be able to do A/B tests of your creative and of that event, even before you kind of go all into developing that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Philip?
An example that I had that I thought was very interesting. There's this this new trend of evolving in the kind of digital entrepreneur space. There's an example from Pat Flynn, and I'll try and link to, I think it's Will It Fly is where the book in which he talks about that in, but it's becoming a pretty popular theory where essentially the process that they recommend is you come up with the concept for what you're trying to sell, so your event, et cetera, your event or your course, or in that example, I think it's a course book, or it's an online course or a product, but it can work with events as well. And you kind of create either a pre-sale or create the page first before you create the product even or the event to kind of judge demand, and then you send out an offer to purchase that thing to a segment of your market. So this can be a segment of, generally it's a segment of highly engaged market that you have. So maybe it's the top 100 families or maybe less, 10 or so people on the list that would be your ideal customers for the thing that you're creating. And then you see whether or not they buy. There's some examples where you can even call and ask them or get their feedback on it or try and figure out why they didn't buy. But really that's the form of testing, to just figure out how that price point sits with them and how eager they are to actually make the purchase. And what's critical to a lot of this pricing theory is that people... It's this weird thing where people can't tell you, people are really bad at making predictions, basically. Even experts, never trust anybody's prediction ever. Don't ever go into your research trying to get a prediction out of people, because predictions never work and people never give them. So the best things you can do is figure out why someone didn't do a thing or what they've done in the past. So the advantage to sending this pricing pre-sale out to people is that it allows you to follow up with them and ask them why they didn't do it. Rather than coming at it from a predictive angle, you can ask people why they didn't purchase that thing and then figure out slide up or down. So basically, depending on the percentage that you get to book for that price point, you could slide up, or you could, if it was too high, you could figure out about sliding down. That's a little bit about testing. I had one more thing to add in here too, is really the inclusion of tiers. It's kind of a little of an awkward thing for Gantam to put in tiered pricing, because we're like a product company and we do have tiers. We do have tiers, but they're more like tiered products. But in general, tiered pricing, because of the contrast principle, is always a thing that you should be engaging in. I'm not sure if we brought up the contrast principle before. I don't think we have. Yeah, I don't think so. But basically, the contrast principle is the reason you have tiers is so that you can always put the highest tier first. You can be like, for this year's event, there's a, there's a VIP package, which is only $99.99. or, you know, $99. So people, you know, and then you come in and say that the regular pricing, or generally no more than three, because people get paralyzed by choices. Generally 2 to 3 choices is the optimal amount of choices, and you always have want to have multiple choices. So stay away from single ticket options, and always offer tiers, and offer them with the higher tier first, so that by contrast, the price you actually want them to pay will seem reasonable. You'll see this all the time in kind of online sales, where they'll have three options and the middle one is the one highlighted. So that's like using both of these techniques put together. It's using the contrast principle, and it's using the kind of the tiered system to allow you to think that there are options that are worth considering. So that's my kind of like take on testing and some examples on contrast principle and tiering. Brad, yeah, what about you?
Yeah, those are great. I think, you know, it's hard to get into pricing when you're not talking about a specific attraction. But I think we've done a pretty good job of, you know, hopefully giving our audience a few ideas of what to think about. The one other thing I wanted to mention, which is not completely specific to the attractions industry, but it's something that is very important to the attractions industry when thinking about pricing, is you have to think about capacity and throughput. I see this happen so many times when an attraction, they want to be that value play, but they don't have a high enough capacity for their attraction. And so what happens is they oversell tickets because they have to sell a certain number of these, you know, cheaper tickets to be able to make up the revenue that they need to operate. But unfortunately, their attraction is not designed for that capacity. So usually if this is like your first year of an event, or your, you know, first year of doing an attraction, my biggest advice to you is, whatever you think the capacity is, divide it in half and do your pricing from there. It's not an exact science, but even, you know, even the bigger theme parks, when we do private events and you know, things like, you know, upcharges like Fright Lanes or smaller experiences, even for seasoned attractions, it's really hard to figure out capacity and throughput in that initial year of operation, until you get, you know, a couple of weeks of actually seeing how guests are acting and operating through your attraction. You can make a really fatal mistake of thinking you're going to be able to you know, have a higher throughput than you actually can. And that can have a huge domino effect, because you'll have a problem on guest satisfaction. Then you also have this huge issue of, you've made this whole pricing model for this certain capacity and your attraction's not able to hit it. And then that can put a lot of attractions out of business. So I would always caution you to, whatever you think the capacity is going to be, divide it in half, create your pricing model from there, and hopefully you'll be pleasantly surprised. And if you are, you can always sell more tickets or adjust that later on, but do not get into the trap of thinking that your haunted house, whatever your seasonal attraction or standalone attraction is, can handle the capacity. I won't name any specifics at Knott's or at other parks, but like I mentioned, I see this all the time in the professional, you know, quote unquote professional side of the industry, where the capacities just don't come through, and it just completely messes up your entire pricing model.
No, consider the perspective from your consumer. You know, consider it, as we've been talking previously in previous episodes, consider it through their buying journey. When they discover you, where do you sit kind of within their lens? This is again to kind of break you out of the internal thinking. You know, too many times I've seen creative teams sit around and price based on what they believe or what they predict or what they say about other people, which are generally, it's never good to come from those angles. You know, come instead from testing with your audience, getting real person information on what price they find acceptable and why, you know, why they didn't buy, why they did. And we talked about some ways to do testing, some A/B testing, or even some spot testing with portions of your group. We talked about never relying on predictions, because predictions are not reliable, including by your team or by experts. We talked about the contrast principle and using tiers and about pricing based on optimal capacity. So I think that's already a lot for everyone to kind of consider.
Yeah, definitely. And if our audience out there, you know, if you're interested in us diving into any of these topics that we mentioned anymore, please visit marketingyourattraction.com. You can sign up for our email list there and get our contact information. You can let us know what you would like us to cover in future episodes, either about pricing or about, you know, other topics that you're interested in. Philip, it's July. It's July 1st. I believe there's only, 27 more days, 28 more days until your leadership symposium.
Goodness. Oh, goodness. Yeah, the symposium's coming up very quickly. An intense day of learning for anyone in the seasonal attraction space. There's a coupon inside the show notes and as well as a link to the page. And I encourage everyone to give it a good think and see if you'd like to come commit to a day of learning. Brad and I will be there signing autographs. for all of our readers, all of our five
$50 an autograph, yes, and $100 for a photo.
No. Yeah, we'll test out how that pricing works.
Right, yes, definitely.
And there's also a link in here to the magazine, the Seasonal Entertainment Source. The next issue mails out in September, so make sure you're on that mailing list to get that next issue.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up episode 18 of the Marketing Your Attraction podcast. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast player. We'll be back here next week with another brand new episode.